CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, independent and diverse campus community radio from Simon Fraser University.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we report on recent successful union certification drives for Uber drivers and Amazon workers in BC on Red Eye. Unpack where healthcare, colonialism, and liberation struggle intersect on Habibti, Please. Investigate the Prime Minister's Western ideological orientation on the Broadbent Institute's perspectives. And look at the birth of eco-development and liberal environmentalism on Cited. But first, this episode's brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, the MB Media Co-op in Moncton, The Independent in St. John's, plus national publications like Press Progress, Pivot, The Breach, and 23 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at Unrigged.ca. Broadcasting since April 2020, the Jack Webster Award-winning Cited is a documentary podcast series telling stories about the politics of science and expertise with host Gordon Caddick in Toronto. On this episode, the show's fourth season continues as the team explore how an Albertan oil man and a socialist policy wonk from Saskatchewan banded together in the 1980s to think up eco-development, a precursor to today's sustainable development. Now, here's Cited.
I'm Gordon Caddick, and this is Cited. You're going to hear about a lot of ideas on green dreams that are truly utopian, or maybe dystopian, depending on who you ask. But this episode couldn't be more mainstream. We're going to be talking about sustainable development. Sustainable development is part of a broader set of ideas that you might call liberal environmentalism. It's hard to notice liberal environmentalism because it's just the water that we now swim in. But as we'll see in this episode, that wasn't always the case. Now, the promise of liberal environmentalism is that we can protect our environment while preserving the existing economic framework. In fact, those two things are supposed to be mutually reinforcing. So this comes with a whole set of policies that I'm sure are familiar to you, like carbon taxes, cap and trade schemes, subsidies for green technology, and other market-based solutions. That's liberal environmentalism. But as we'll learn on this episode, liberal environmentalism came out of a unique political and intellectual history. In the late 60s and early 70s, there were much more radical political currents swirling, like degrowth environmentalism and movements for environmental and economic justice. These currents created a political and intellectual maelstrom, and from that maelstrom, a new way of thinking was born, a new green dream. This was all guided by two unlikely dreamers, two Canadians, in fact, a socialist policy wonk from Saskatchewan named Jim McNeill and an Albertan oil man and globe-trotting elite named Maurice Strong. If you've never heard of them, you're not alone. But despite their relative anonymity, they are arguably the most important environmental thinkers, well, maybe ever? because this is the story of our reigning green dream. This is the story of two people who convinced many of us that capitalism and environmental sustainability could indeed be made compatible. But maybe that is actually a pretty utopian green dream. After the break, Mark Apollonio and I bring you episode 2, The Green Wonks, the birth of liberal environmentalism.
The climate is changing, so are we. I'm Laura Lynch, and I host What on Earth? That's CBC's Climate Solutions podcast. Twice a week, we take you around the world to find the people who are trying to build a better future for all of us. We explore indigenous science, new technologies. We talk openly about mental health and climate anxiety. We also take your smart questions all the time. Come find What on Earth wherever you get your podcasts.
Our story about liberal environmentalism starts in an unexpected place, the Canadian province of Saskatchewan. And it starts with a socialist policy wonk named Jim McNeil. Unfortunately, McNeil is no longer with us, and we weren't able to find much audio. But McNeil did leave an unpublished memoir, and his daughter will be our guide through the story found in those pages.
So it was in 1933, he thinks. He would have been about 5 years old. And they're driving south in the Model A Ford with his dad at the wheel.
Catherine McNeil Hodgins is talking about her father's earliest memory. His family was on a road trip just south of Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. Jim McNeil reminisces about that trip in his unpublished memoir.
And it talks about the prairie sky being bright and blue and the countryside is barren after several years of drought. And the normally boundless horizon is interrupted by rolling sand dunes, which have buried the road. And as they go along, his dad is navigating past broken fence posts and tilting telephone poles, and they're getting shorter and shorter as the dunes get bigger and bigger. So the telephone poles, that iconic Saskatchewan view, they're disappearing. And finally, his mom says to his dad, "Are we lost?" And he says, "Yes, Helga, I'm afraid we are." And then he points out to the dunes. He says, "Their house has got to be out there, but it's buried." And my grandmother starts to cry.
McNeil was born in 1928 in the community of Mazenod in the south of Saskatchewan, a part of the country devastated by the biblical disasters of the Dust Bowl, plagues of insects, drought, dust storms, economic and ecological collapse.
That generation of people from the prairie were forever, I think, marked by living through that depression. The homeless, the jobless, the hungry, the ecological devastation.
How Jim became an environmentalist, I don't think you have much choice when you live through an ecological disaster as significant as a Dust Bowl.
That's Elizabeth May. If you live in Canada and you have any interest in politics, you surely know her. She is leader of the Green Party of Canada.
Her relationship with McNeil started in the mid-1980s, when they were both hanging out in the same policy circles. But they became close, and eventually they became like family.
Well, Jim and Phil McNeil were almost adoptive parents. I mean, Jim and Phil's daughter, Kath, refers to me as her sister. Jim had a very challenging childhood, including being laid up for more than a year with polio. His father was a genius, had an instinct for how to keep his son's muscles from atrophying when no one else did. Massaged his limbs with olive oil, where he heard this, I don't know. But nobody else was taking care of a child with exactly the degree of attention, care.
Jim McNeil's father was a teacher, and he scored his family a way out of the Dust Bowl by landing the job of vice principal in a school 400 kilometers away in the town of Sturgis, Saskatchewan.
And so they moved, what Dad used to say, it was from the Dead Sea to the Garden of Eden, as they moved north to Sturgis.
McNeil was only a toddler at the time, but he carried the significance of that move with him his whole life.
And he often said in his speeches that he was an ecological refugee at the age of three. That's a phrase that comes up a lot with Dad.
McNeil's childhood in Sturgis was a happy one. Despite the polio leaving him with a lifelong limp, his youth was physical and out of doors, where he worked on nearby farms, delivered the local paper, and eventually worked as an assistant carpenter.
After high school, McNeil went off to the University of Saskatchewan. While studying there, he also got involved in politics, and specifically with the party that led Saskatchewan at the time, the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, better known as the CCF. The CCF formed the first ever socialist government in North America. That party is a precursor to today's New Democratic Party. That's the most left-wing of the mainstream Canadian political parties.
After his undergrad, McNeil went to Sweden to get a graduate degree in economics and political science from the University of Stockholm.
Upon his return to Canada in 1952, McNeil wrote a series of articles for the Commonwealth. That's the official paper of the CCF. His articles applauded the Swedish approach to labor relations.
And the right person saw them. A senior CCF bureaucrat read the articles and then called up McNeil and offered him a job.
By the time that McNeil landed his job in 1952, the CCF had been in power for 8 years. Their premier was a charismatic prairie populist, a former youth boxing champion, Baptist preacher, and a passionate champion for farmers and for working-class Saskatchewanians. His name was Tommy Douglas.
We would provide health care for every man, woman, and child, irrespective of their color, their race, or their financial status, and by God, we're going to do it!
Douglas is widely celebrated in Canada for being the father of Medicare. But that came many years later. Back in the early 50s, McNeil had just become one of Douglas's policy wonks, and the two quickly became inseparable.
He never called him Tommy, TC. He came back to work for TC Douglas and became one of his senior echelon policy mandarins, civil service geniuses. But, you know, ate lunch with him every day, knew him inside and out. He was one of his trusted people.
McNeil would be running a massive new infrastructure operation, the largest multi-purpose water development project in the country's history.
I remember Dad talking about the South Saskatchewan Dam project that he was involved in when he worked for Tommy Douglas's government.
In 1959, the provincial and federal governments partnered on the South Saskatchewan River Dam project. This was a project that would create two massive dams and a whole lot more. This effort was all ultimately about bringing water to an otherwise arid region.
They would have this dam, they would have these water reservoirs. That was born out of the Depression and the drought of the Depression. They would prevent the 1930s from happening again.
And it would be McNeil who'd make sure of it. He oversaw all the province's responsibilities in this project, and he reported directly to Tommy Douglas.
McNeil was the right man for the job because the South Saskatchewan River Dam project was a huge success. To this day, it's considered a monumental achievement in Canadian engineering, and it had a profound impact on the development of Saskatchewan's economy. So McNeil and Douglas were literally building the physical infrastructure for a modern state, a state committed to social welfare, conservation, and environmental sustainability.
In his memoir, McNeil raves about the dam. He sees it as emblematic of the CCF and their socialist vision.
We established three provincial parks and made possible another four regional parks.
This is producer Jay Coburn playing the role of Jim McNeil.
We planted millions of trees in the park areas. And during my visits over the following decades, I took great joy in watching these forests grow to maturity. The project has achieved many of its planned objectives, and I believe its potential for ensuring the future of this increasingly arid area looks promising.
The lessons that McNeil learned here were formative, because that dam is emblematic of the political vision we'll see throughout the rest of this story. Jim McNeil's political vision, or his theory of political change, it puts socially responsible policy wonks at the center. It suggests that their big plans can solve our big problems, so long as they have the backing of a political visionary.
But in the 1964 provincial election, McNeil would lose his political visionary. After 20 years in power, Tommy Douglas and the CCF lost by the narrowest of margins to the provincial Liberals. So McNeil, he needed a new gig.
When the T.C. Douglas government, after all of its wonderful successes, was defeated, a whole lot of very talented Saskatchewan senior civil servants moved to Ottawa and more or less took over Ottawa. Obviously, they didn't take every single government position, but there was a very strong cadre of highly respected CCFers trained under T.C. Douglas's government who became, well, legendary, brilliant senior civil servants.
There's a highlight from a new episode of Cited. Find the archives at citedmedia.ca, at harbingermedianetwork.com, wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Broadcasting since September 2020, Habib T. Please features activist and academic Nashmalina Khan exploring politics, pop culture, and beyond from an internationalist and Canadian perspective. On this week's episode, she sits down with public health physician and activist Dr. Yipeng Gui for a conversation unpacking the entanglement of healthcare, colonialism, and liberation struggles, and his firsthand experience in Rafah witnessing malnutrition and attacks on Gaza's hospitals. Now, here's the show.
You're listening to Habib T. Please. I'm Nashwalina Khan. Medicine is never neutral. To practice medicine is to reckon with colonialism, to speak out against genocide, and to insist that care is inseparable from justice. Yes, they made him. Kush, they made him. Canadian hospitals to Rafah, my guest today's work reminds us that solidarity is never abstract. It is embodied, it is risky, and it is life-affirming. In this episode, you'll be hearing a conversation with Dr. Yipeng Gui, public health physician, activist, and someone who has pushed us to think differently about what medicine can and should be. This conversation is part of our ongoing series with health professionals who are challenging the colonial and institutional limits of their own field. I believe it is vital to highlight people in medicine who not only heal patients, but also confront the systems that create harm in the first place. By sharing stories like Yipeng's, we can better imagine what it means to practice medicine as an act of resistance, solidarity, and care. Hi, Yipeng. Thanks for joining Habib T. Please today.
Hi, Nashwa. Thank you for having me.
And Yipeng, I think it's like such a lovely coincidence that we both went to McMaster together, kind of overlap but didn't, but I have a feeling some of the core beliefs and teachings at that undergraduate age when you're just getting out of high school may have come from that training. McMaster, for people who are unfamiliar with it, purports itself, especially like the health sciences programs and other programs now too, on problem-based learning, but also a lot of health equity and medicine, some classes and electives about medicine and health studies and health sciences rooted in an equity lens. And I wanted to know what medicine means for you, not as just a profession, but a calling, or what that kind of formative education in your early 20s did that helps you do what you do now.
Yeah, like the experience of going to undergrad in Hamilton, which is very close to Six Nations of the Grand River, and to know that, you know, a place like McMaster too also has like an Indigenous studies program, but only because people like Don Martin Hill, who's from Six Nations, pushed for it and advocated for it, was really like such a formative time in my life, because I only knew so much about Indigenous health and also only knew so much about how to navigate this world as a young person, in terms of like, how do we question things? How do we critique things? How do we like envision a world that looks different? and be unapologetic about that, because I think a lot of education tries to put students in this hierarchical place of, you go into this lecture hall and there's hundreds, if not thousands, of other students in that same lecture hall, and you're treated as a number, you're treated as someone who consumes that knowledge and not as someone who practices the knowledge. And I think for those various factors of like being at a program and university that allowed me to kind of unlearn some of those things about education, of like, I'm not just a consumer and recipient of education, but it's actually something that you also practice. It's also something that you think about how to start using right away. And also, how do you learn about historical and ongoing injustices within the health sphere, learning about Indigenous health. Quite honestly, for like the first time in its like depth and breadth of the genocide of Indigenous peoples, it was a completely transformative time, because it made me rethink a lot of the things that I previously knew growing up in Southwestern Ontario as someone who's benefited from things like Canadian citizenship, things like the privilege and opportunity of living on stolen land, and made me really think about how best to move forward, understanding and knowing these contradictions of my life, and how to do that work in a good way, learning with community, from community, and spending a lot of time at Six Nations of the Grand River with Haudenosaunee scholars and clinicians and community members, so that we can work towards a world that dismantles forms of oppression, and that is not limited to just Turtle Island. We can see that in many other parts of the world with this, the colonial ideology that rapes, pillages, decimates Indigenous land and Indigenous bodies around the world.
Thank you. And I remember the first time I also went to Six Nations as an undergrad, and it's like, until you, if you're somebody who is like an immigrant kid, like I was, and until you like go and know those things, like I knew things because of land acknowledgements and pieces like that, but it's not, it's like the discrepancy, like you said. Like I remember the Hill family also advocating for a program there at McMaster, and now McMaster really prides itself on that and having that program, and it's kind of just a contradiction to like what it actually took to get that program. And I remember making moccasins in a basement at McMaster, like the one of the integrated science buildings, because there was no space. There was no other space at the time in 2009. And so now McMaster is very like, we center this, we have this. And it was like a big, like a lot of work. So thank you for sharing that, and how that teaches us how to move in the world in a different way once you know and you try to understand the benefits and privileges we have from that. And at the recent People's Conference for Palestine, which just happened in Detroit, you posted the words of a doctor, and I think it's really interesting to talk to doctors about their role in genocide and what medicine's role is. And it was Dr. Nidal Jabbour who wrote, "Fighting genocide is medicine," or who said, "Fighting genocide is medicine, fighting genocide is medicine, liberation is medicine, liberation is medicine, freedom is medicine, freedom is medicine," who's part of Doctors Against Genocide. And I assume you're part of that group, and I wanted to ask for you, what does that mean, that medicine is freedom, medicine is liberation, and fighting genocide is medicine?
I mean, I was also just thinking about how I was able to learn about Indigenous health in the context of like Turtle Island, and learning about like what it means to be like liberated from these forms of oppression, only because the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and its calls to action, all of that was around the time I was starting undergrad. And that was because residential school survivors of the, you know, genocide here on Turtle Island, they were organizing, they were pushing, they were getting their stories told and heard by the mainstream population and the media. And it was through those efforts that we were able to have more of these conversations, the same way that like people like Dawn Martin Hill pushed for an Indigenous studies program at McMaster, because she wanted to learn about what happened to her peoples. And it's only why the university can have these kinds of nice things that they applaud themselves now for having, when they actually had so much resistance against the people that wanted to have these kind of things in the first place. And that pattern kind of unfolds itself in all these different ways for many different communities and peoples. But Dr. Nidal Jabour's words struck me because it is what I've known all along in spending time with Indigenous peoples, is you cannot provide aid. You cannot provide like what we think of as Western medicine. You cannot like provide housing or food alone. Those things will not bring liberation. Those things will not bring self-determination. Those are the things necessary for communities that ultimately know the solutions to their own complex problems. And it's often imposed upon them, like systems of oppression, mainly colonialism, that disempowers, disenfranchises, and also removes them sometimes from their culture, from their language, from their communities, from their land. And it's all those things that are necessary for people to thrive and communities to thrive. And so that quote by Dr. Nidal Jabour, I think about in the context of Turtle Island. I obviously think about it in the context of Palestine, and that's the context in which he spoke about it at the People's Conference for Palestine, is that a precursor for health in Palestine, anywhere in Palestine, and particularly in Gaza, it is liberation, it is freedom, it is ending the genocide. And those are the things necessary to improve everyone's health in Palestine.
And you post on social media, including these words, a lot. And I have talked about this on two episodes ago with Dr. Tariq Lubani about even myself, like I was implicated for posting. And that's like nothing in the face of a genocide at all, with an understanding that the cost we all pay here is nothing. I wanted to ask you, why do you think it's important to share words like Dr. Jabour's and other pieces you share about resistance, about Palestinian solidarity in the context of working in the field you work in, and how the costs we quote unquote pay here are actually nothing? Like, solidarity should come at a cost, actually, in times of genocide.
Solidarity always comes at a cost. There's always a risk and something you put on the line. I think that is what solidarity is. Like, the most clear example is when you have privilege and opportunity in this world and you want to be in solidarity or with solidarity with people who are marginalized, oppressed, colonized, it means you put your voice, and even better, you put your body on the line. Mm-hmm. And you get in the way because you have that privilege and opportunity, and you say, no, like, I oppose this, and here's what I'm doing to oppose it. And you're taking direction from the people who are oppressed, from the people who are marginalized, from the people who are colonized, and you listen to them, and you do the things necessary to center them, but ultimately get in the way. You get in the way of their erasure. You get in the way of their expulsion. You get in the way of their extinction by putting your body on the line. And of course, that comes with risks. Like we see with activists who have spent time in Gaza, who have spent time in the West Bank, who have lost their lives because they've been murdered by the Israeli occupation. And we see those same examples for water and land defenders on Turtle Island, people who get in the way of these companies that only know profit and only know like colonial erasure and domination and subjugation as a means for more profit, as a means for more land ownership and things like that. So yeah, that's my assessment of like what it means to be in solidarity, I think. And the things that you mentioned earlier around what it takes to get there, like none of us who have a lot of privilege or have a lot of opportunity, don't suddenly kind of get there. It is a process of learning and unlearning. And for many folks who have the privilege of unlearning, it's because you didn't grow up facing structural oppression and racism head on. There are people who are born into this world and their existence is political. Their identity is political. And